These days, most artists use paint that's made from plastic and comes from a factory. David Coles makes paint the old way, in a studio in Melbourne, up to his elbows in buttery, slippery, oozing paint, using a 50-year-old German processing mill that was once used for cocoa. If you didn't know he was making colours, you'd swear he was making confectionery, watching these dough-like pigments unfurl from the machine. David Coles is a master paint maker, one of the world's most respected makers of artists' oil paints. His raw materials come from all over the world. Lapis blue from Afghanistan, cadmium orange mined in Derbyshire, rose madder from the madder plant found only in certain parts of Iran. David has put together an exhibition in Melbourne. It's called Chromatopia, and it tells the story of the history of colour, a story that spans thousands of years and across the globe. Hello, David.
Hello, Richard. How are you?
I'm well, sir. I read a bit about the Romans and how much they love purple. Like purple, I think it was like a pound of purple silk was the most valuable commodity in the whole of the Roman Empire. One factor was the silk. The other factor was the purple. Can you tell me, how did they manufacture purple dye?
It was the most extraordinary process. Basically, Tyrian purple, which is the purple of the emperors of ancient Rome, came from a little whelk, a little murex predatory sea snail.
A sea snail?
A sea snail. And it has this one little gland, and it produces one drop of a clear liquid. But they found that when it gets exposed to air, it turns textiles into this most extraordinary deep violet.
A single snail, yeah. And they get one drop out of that, do they?
Yeah, so right. 250,000 of the snails needed for 1 ounce of the dye.
I thought it was the shell. I thought it would be in the shell, but it's actually from a gland.
It's from a gland. Inside of it.
Where did they make such things? Such
like dye? All dye industries, right at the edge of town, if not if the burghers of a city would have any choice, they'd have them outside of the town, because all dye making stank to high heaven. And in particular, if you could imagine a fish market at the end of the day, times a million, and a hot summer's day, the smell would have been absolutely horrific.
Nowhere near the city of Rome, I expect, then.
No. Well, of course, the producers of the... It was called Tyrian purple because it came from the city of Tyre in old Phoenicia, which is now modern Lebanon. And all the beaches you now still see along that part of the coast are actually really broken up seashells from the murex. It's not so much sand as actually finely ground up seashells.
Really?
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
Right, after centuries of Roman purple being
absolutely,
made.
Absolutely, yeah.
Cochineal red. Is that made of a kind of a animal blood or a blood bloody dye of some kind?
So cochineal is discovered in the early 16th century when the Spanish invaded the Central and South America and discovered the Aztecs and the Inca cultures had been using cochineal, which is a small-scale insect. It grows on the prickly pear, the nopal pear. And they've been cultivating it for centuries, making this beautiful red dye that actually comes, I have to tell you, from the babies, from the female of this little scale insect called a cochineal.
Right. Is it the blood or is it just the wings?
It's the blood.
It's the blood again.
Yeah. Yeah. By the time those cochineal beetles reach us over here in around the world, whether it's Australia or Europe, they've been dried and they're quite hard and they need to be soaked to release their colour. But if you go over to the actual plantations in Central America, Peru and Mexico, you can just take the little bugs off of the prickly pear and just squeeze them between your fingers and they just burst and it's just pure crimson red.
How in those times would they have made a large amount of this dye then?
They made horrific amounts of the dye. Everything, the Aztecs and Incas loved colour and so they would have been taking colour from wherever they could. The cochineal that they were using and that we still continue to use now was cultivated. It wasn't the wild cochineal. So they'd actually bred the cochineal to produce a deeper, stronger colour than was actually available in the wild. So they were very sophisticated in their use of colour.
Europeans would have been using another kind of dye for red before then, surely, before they found this red in the New World, wouldn't they?
Yeah, prior to the invasion of the New World, Europeans were using, there was another scale insect called kermes, which came from Northern Europe, and also another insect again called grain, which produced a very, very deep crimson dye as well. Of course, in the words of Chaucer, he talked about the fact that something would be dyed in the grain, meaning that it was long-lasting and held its colour. And we now sort of convert that into the English language as meaning something that holds.
If the Romans had access to red and the access to blue, why were they squeezing snails? Why didn't they just simply mix red and blue to make purple if it was that rare?
Well, there's two things to this. One, colour, I can tell you as an artist and a maker of artist pigments, is that unfortunately virtually no pigments have ever been made for artists. They're always a byproduct of a larger industry. And probably the biggest industry that colour is produced for would be textiles, for dyeing clothes. And the problem when you have multiple dye colours is that one colour will fade before the other. And so you actually end up with a colour that doesn't seem to sit very well on the wearer.
Ah, I see. So if you'd made a purple out of it, mixing red and blue,
and one of the colours would disappear earlier than the other. One of the most famous of that, of course, is blacks, because there were virtually no black dyes available until the discovery of logwood in Central America, what modern Belize. And before that, you used to be able to have black dyes by purely over dyeing with multiple colours, reds and blues, etc., until you got a black. And that was very important, obviously, for the Puritans and for anybody who was highly pious. They wanted to wear something that had no frivolity to it. The problem was that they would buy something black, and with one of the colours fading, you would actually end up with colour coming through. So they were very happy when logwood, a black dye, finally appears in the 17th century.
Black pudding, so black, even the white bits are black. Hey? So there is a black then. There's not just, I always thought it was over-dyed blue or over-dyed red.
Yeah, up until really the invention of logwood, there really was only one way of doing it, over-dyeing, absolutely.
When cochineal was made and brought back to Europe, what kind of things was it used for then as a dye?
As a dye, just for clothes. The court of Philip and Isabella, they went absolutely nuts for this extraordinary deep crimson colour that they could dye any kind of their fabrics, silks, woolens, linens, etc.
Cardinals? I mean,
and of course, that was the other thing. It was able to be taken up and used by the Roman Catholic Church for popes. It was very much the colour of the Catholic Church.
Is cochineal making a comeback?
It is, and it has had, it never quite completely went away, but in the late 19th century with the invention of modern synthetic pigments and dyes, meaning that these are colours that are created out of organic synthetic materials from coal tar dyes, a lot of these natural colours almost disappeared. The big thing is that they can't be ingested. They're not approved by the FDA. And so what's happened is that these colours like cochineal have made their way back in again, used in foods and used in cosmetics. So drinks like Campari use cochineal. That's why Campari is that beautiful deep crimson colour.
Get out.
And also, most of the fruit juices that are blackcurrant fruit juices are really coloured with cochineal.
Insect blood?
Yes. I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but that's true, absolutely.
It's good. Just as well my vegan producer had stepped out of the room just for a moment when you said that. That's very good to know. Indian yellow is a colour that was very sought after in the 1800s. How was that made?
Well, that was the thing. For decades, no one really knew. These balls, about the size of a small tennis ball, would turn up in England. The British seemed to be the highest users in the West for using Indian yellow. These balls would turn up a kind of a musty orangey-yellow colour with an extremely distinct urine odour to them.
Oh, dear. Yes.
They thought that maybe it was the urine of camels, of snakes, and eventually an Indian administrator went down to Mirzapur, the only village that actually produced Indian yellow, to find out exactly what was going on. It is, of course, the urine of cows. Cows fed exclusively on mango leaves, and so the yellow from the mango leaves dyes the urine of the cows, and they pee it onto a very fine sand where it is then taken up, formed into balls and dried out.
So the paint then is, or the dye, is the sand and this mango-fed cow urine, is it?
It's really the
fine paste.
It's a very fine paste, and then the actual colour is extracted out at the very end, and it's a kind of deep orangey-yellow, glazing yellow.
How about greens? I would have thought greens would be pretty easy to get hold of.
You see, that's the thing. Nature, of course, is when we look in the landscape, we're surrounded by greens, but there aren't actually many greens available naturally that we can use for permanent use. In other words, that's something that will last, that won't fade away. If you've ever been a kid and you've taken some saps, some juices from plants and tried to paint with them or draw with them, they'll immediately put some colour down, but within a day or so, they've disappeared. Same thing was true for artists. They couldn't find any greens coming straight out of nature that were permanent. The only greens available for centuries was really malachite, which is a natural green mineral.
All right. What about copper? Oxidized copper?
And you can oxidize copper to make verdigris. But verdigris is very poisonous. It's copper arsenite. And also, it's also very gritty. And the other problem is that it tends to react with other materials around it, especially other colors, and go brown. So there are some very famous Renaissance paintings, even by great exponents of a quality in the way of putting paintings together, like Titian. And there are painting areas where what would have been bright green leaves are now a dark brown.
Some of those paintings from artists like Turner, which often have those beautiful smears of grey and yellow. Are you talking about those yellow smears would be casual?
Oh, Turner was definitely a user of Indian yellow, absolutely. Right. I mean, artists, don't forget, in the past have lived through a paucity of colour. If they had access to the amount of colours and permanent colours that we have available to us now, they would have gone for it. Every generation you see artists taking up with great gusto any new development, because what was available to them before was often very limited. I mean, the palette of the ancient Romans was very limited. It expanded into the Middle Ages and expanded into the Renaissance and expanded with the beginning of the modern Industrial Revolution.
With frescoes in the Renaissance, that's paint mixed with egg white, isn't it?
Fresco is painting onto a damp lime plaster, and you mix your pigments with water just into a kind of a paste consistency so it can be applied, and it's brushed onto the damp plaster, and as the plaster dries, it sucks the pigment into just the very top surface, and it's locked in a very crystalline fashion. But of course, there's nothing in between the pigments to discolor, so that when you see frescoes, you see how pure the colour is, the most famous being, say, the frescoes of Giotto down over in Padua. The blues there are still as fresh as they were 700 years ago.
The way you're talking, it sounds like paints up until very recently was very rare and would have had to have been used very sparingly then.
The pigments were expensive. The opportunities to make money were limited because you normally had to have a patron. Most artists who even be allowed to be able to approach patrons had to become a member of the Guild of St. Luke, which was like a closed shop union. You had to do an apprenticeship to be able to then do your pieces that you would show to the committee to be allowed to join the guild, and from that point you were able to actually get commissions. But in regards to the actual materials that you were able to work with, what you could afford, very limited.
So a huge canvas then would be a sign of wealth and opulence. It's a way of showing off, I have this much paint, I can afford to splash it around like
absolutely.
This.
Absolutely, yes.
Lead white is a famous paint insofar as it drove artists and other people mad. How was lead white made? How was that actually manufactured?
The Greeks had discovered fairly early on that lead would oxidize, and they could see a white kind of coloration, pigment coming from it. And for many centuries, it was a very simple material that worked okay. But really, it was later in the Middle Ages that manufacturers or artisans started to realize they could become much more sophisticated and get a very strong white material. In fact, lead white right up until really the end of the 19th century was the only white used by mankind for 5,000 years. Lead is exposed to the fumes of vinegar and the fumes of warm manure. The manure gives off carbon dioxide, the vinegar gives off acetic acid, and the two combine to create carbonic acid, which reacts and creates a white rust, in essence, on the lead.
See, I'm just laughing because this reminds me of the conversation I had years ago with a master perfumier, and paint is a lot like perfume. It's this exquisite thing that's made from really disgusting things, by and large. Stinky, disgusting things like that.
Yeah. Because historically, these are chemicals that were simple and easily available. We live in an age now where we can buy, if I wanted to go to a laboratory house, I can buy every chemical in a analytical grade, 99.99% pure, and I have a wealth of choice in regards to what I want to use. Prior to the 18th century, this just wasn't available, and so the strongest acids available were mostly from vinegars or from the refuse from the winemaking industry, and alkalis would have come from lime. So the very, very basic alkalis and acids, they were very simple processes, and they used whatever was to hand. It was as simple as that.
You're also using a lot of chemistry here. Much of your work, I suppose, involves a good foundational knowledge of chemistry.
Yes, I do stand on the shoulders of giants. I'm an artist first and foremost, or I still consider myself an artist. I went through art school, and for many years, even after starting my own business making artist paints, I still continued a professional practice in being an artist. But, of course, doing what I'm doing, I couldn't have done it without learning chemistry. So I'm somewhat just above being a bucket chemist. I do read my chemistry, and I'm very, very fortunate to be able to have consultant chemists who help us out a lot.
It's almost a bit like alchemy, actually, in a way, isn't it? There's some kind of magic to it, though.
Yeah, and the alchemy bit is, to be honest with you, is probably what draws me in more than anything else, because there's poetry in it.
You grew up in England, and your family had an art shop. What was that like for you? Was that like growing up in a sweet shop?
Yeah, no. What you don't realize is different from anybody else. I thought that's kind of a normal thing to do. My father was a commercial illustrator, so he was an artist. So I grew up in an artistic sort of family. My brother and I both ended up in the arts. And I just, what it was fantastic was to be surrounded by this colour. And of course, you know, I got a rudimentary understanding of the materials and how they were put together.
That meant you had better gear than the other kids with textures, I suppose, didn't
well,
it? You
know? Yeah, there was that. And then, of course, I can remember being at art school, and every other art student would have the big tins of the cheapest, nastiest paint possible, and I'd have my selection of the best oil paints available in the world. Yeah.
Was it a given that you would go to art school?
Nope, wasn't a given, but there was certainly, unlike probably many families, and certainly a lot of artist friends of mine, their families were dead set against them going to art school. My family would have been happier, I think, if I'd gone to university to study, say, English or something. But it felt a natural, I certainly have a facility for drawing and painting, and it felt right to go to art school, and I did believe I would be an artist, yeah.
You went to art school in Bristol, which is a big university town. What was that like, that scene there at the time?
Well, that, you know, this was the mid-80s, and I just lucked out, because we're talking about an age, we were living under Thatcher, it was a pressure cooker. People were punk and post-punk, so everything was DIY. Quite simply, the attitude was, you want to get it done, do it yourself.
Make your own fun.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. So the band scene was enormous, and we're talking about, I was at art school, and I was in painting. A friend of mine, Andy, was over in graphics, and he was part of Massive Attack. We had Tricky, Portishead were just down the road. I'd gone to school with, and she ended up in Bristol as well with me from the Sundays. It was like there was a musical kind of sort of pressure cooker in that sense. Plus, there was a point of reference. Bristol was great at that time, a large Caribbean population, black Caribbean population. And so we used to go down to all of the dub clubs where you would see a full range of from 17-year-olds to 90-year-olds dancing in a little hall. And that crossed over back into the middle class, white, artistic, and, you know, uni students, and it became this sort of crossover that developed trip-hop and came out of hip-hop.
Yeah, so that kind of cross-fertilization there between... Southern England's always had that kind of, I don't know, this kind of real love of esoteric music, the Pink Floyd, Kate Bush side of the south of England. When that intersects with Afro-Caribbean music, that's when you get Massive Attack.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what was critical about Bristol at that time was that it wasn't London, it was cheap, and the cross-fertilization, the movement between the university students and the black population down in their part of, and of course, classic British city, you'd have a relatively segregated section where the immigrants who had come over post-war were living. And just because also through the 70s there'd been the extraordinary flowering of reggae and dub through Bob Marley, it just all came together at once, really. You know, so you've got a post-punk scene, you've got a late reggae dub, heavy dub scene, and it just pulled together. But everyone was into it. I mean, everyone was pushing to get it made.
Britain's art schools are, in fact, music factories, somehow. Yeah. I don't know why that is. The Beatles came out of art school. The Clash came out of art school. Massive Attacks coming out of art school. Why are England's art schools so good for music in a funny sort of way?
I think that's a good question.
Just a lot probably of they were given drinking or something.
I was going to say, at that time, a lot of drinking, a lot of smoking, a lot of freedom. We were very lucky that particular point where you went to university or art school or drama school or wherever you were doing, we had full grants. not only did we not have to pay at all for our education, we were actually given living grants on top of that. So that would actually pay for your rental and for food and everything. It lasted a brief little period of about 15 years. I can't imagine what it must be like for students now with massive hex debts, but I certainly could imagine that it puts enormous amount of pressure on you to try and make that money back as quickly as possible. We had just extraordinary freedom.
You worked for a while, David, as a flyman at the Bristol Hippodrome. Yeah. What on earth is a flyman?
So you leave. Right, in my case, you leave art school. And cold, harsh reality is you've got to find a job because now you don't have a grant and you have to find a job. A very good friend of mine was working in the theatre, the Bristol Hippodrome, and he basically said there was some work going on down there, which I took, and I was there in the end for almost 2 years. A flyman, in essence, is up in the gantries behind the scenes, and we are pulling on ropes, pulling and dropping down the backdrops for the stage productions.
So much can go wrong with that kind of work.
It was so archaic. It was a dim gantry with a series of ropes with a little ribbon on the what they called the in, meaning the point where the bottom of the bar of the backdrop was literally sitting just on the stage floor. And then there would be an out ribbon, which is when the backdrop was out of view of the audience. You would have cans on your ears just being told when to pull the next rope. You have a little break, and as soon as the green light went, you took off the break, and with all your weight, you jumped up and pulled the rope down to be pulling these backdrops in as quickly as possible onto the stage.
Did it ever go wrong?
Always. Always went wrong, because you had about 4 foot to actually sit with enough light to be able to see this little tiny little ribbon on the rope zooming down towards you, which you're meant to then clamp straight onto the brake, and it'll be perfectly sitting on the stage floor.
You can kill an actor if you're not careful and stuff like that too. That's the other thing, can't you?
Yeah. Now, the worst of it, we tried desperately not, because you would always, as soon as there was the sound of the metal bar smacking onto the stage floor, you'd have stage manager in your can swearing his mouth off at you. It was never great. And you also knew probably at the end of the day that they were also going to come over and give you a smack around the back of the head.
I suppose it would have been quite a nocturnal lifestyle.
Totally. And that's what the reason why eventually I had to get out of it. It completely does your head in. You're either born to do it, and friends of mine still do. They've been doing it for 40 years. Or you realize that it's just not really it's a very strange way of living your life. You get to the stage door an hour prior to curtain up. So you're there around about 6 o'clock. You do the whole show. You then reset the stage. When I was living in Bristol, we still had the very archaic licensing laws, so most pubs closed at 11 o'clock. The only pubs that were got around this were what were called stage pubs, theatre pubs, and they actually were allowed to be open as long as they wanted to. It was, in essence, like a glorified lock-in every night.
Mm, thank God for those. I remember those.
Yes. Well, lock-ins were great, but there was always a little bit sort of like, is it going to happen tonight? Is it not going to happen tonight? A theatre pub would always be open. The problem, of course, with that is that the next thing you knew, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. You'd had a skinful.
Right.
Then you went home, then you slept, then you got up, and it would normally be, you know, ready to go back to stage, which meant that I spent through the winter, I did not see the sunlight.
So after you got out of that, where did you go then?
And then I decided it was time to move to London. So moved up to London, and at that point started looking for work. And again, still tough times. We're talking about the mid to late 80s. And I'd been told by a friend of mine that there was a moving company, and what we thought originally was an art moving company, and they would want to just employ artists. The guy who owned the company was an artist, and he employed artists, and it was a great way of us all working part-time. The problem was that there isn't actually enough art to be moved around to sustain a business. And so he was seconding us out to Westminster Council to do homeless persons unit. Homeless persons unit is, in essence, moving people who have just arrived in the borough, and before we can get them into an actual council, a permanent council house, they're being moved into temporary accommodation. And that can be from 6 months all the way up to 6 years, depending on their level of need.
So you would have had a lot of migrant families then?
It was 90% migrant families, and obviously also a lot of domestic issue families as well.
All right, women escaping domestic violence.
Sorry, exactly that, yeah.
What finished that gig for you?
It's too difficult emotionally. You saw some awful stuff. In particular with the domestic violence, we saw some awful things. I got involved once whereby we were moving a young woman and her two children, very young children. And the boyfriend the previous night had beaten her up and he'd been locked up, but he was getting out the next morning after a hearing, after bail, with bail application, and we'd been brought in to take her out to a safe house. Unfortunately, the hearing had happened quite a bit earlier than was originally anticipated, and he turned up. We thought this might happen, so this is before mobile phones, so the only way of communication, well, for most of us, of course, would be to run down to the local payphone. Luckily, we had one of the guys on the council. He had a walkie-talkie. But we had to lock ourselves in the room that we were trying to get her out of. Whilst he went, the boyfriend went off and came back with an axe and started trying to axe his way through the front door. And we were just waiting, hoping that the police would turn up and arrest him before he got through the door. It was a little bit like a Jack Nicholson movie.
It was a bit of an education, being exposed
It was. You took it on the chin. I mean, I don't regret for a minute taking that job and it being exposed to all sides of humanity, because it's very easy to be sheltered, to live a sheltered life. I mean, not that I don't wish harm on anybody, but to actually experience the difficulties that people go through.
On ABC Radio, this is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Podcast, broadcast, and online. All our conversations are available on the ABC Radio app. Or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
We were saying before, you had this hideous job for a while as a removalist. Then you got a job in one of the world's oldest art shops in London. Tell me about this place.
So Cornelison & Son is one of the last of the great old art shops. The world used to be full of these for 150, 200 years. There was shops that sold artist pigments, and the knowledge base from the staff was extraordinary. And as a kid, I actually used to get taken up to London by my father, who had a studio, Soho, on Longacre. And the extension of Longacre is Great Queen Street. And there was the original Cornelison, set up in 1861. And I remember walking in there. And the gentlemen all seemed to be in their 70s. And they wore the long brown aprons. And they seemed so scary.
Yeah, I think I've been in there once. It's got all these timber floors and beautiful old timber shelving and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. It's almost like a library or something like that.
Somewhere between an apothecary, something out of Hogwarts, or, you know, a Harry Potter book, and certainly high Victorian. When they had to actually move the shop in the mid-80s, Nicholas Walt, the owner of Cornelison, found a new space on Great Russell Street, just down from the British Museum. And they literally disassembled the whole store and reassembled it in the new space. So when you do go there, and I certainly recommend anybody who has a love of history and just the evocation of a kind of a bygone era, then to walk in, and these extraordinary giant Victorian glass jars full of the pigments.
Tell me about the man who sold pen nibs back at that shop.
His nibs.
That's what they called him, his nibs?
They called him his nibs. Right. Philip Poole. Philip was a cantankerous old bugger. He would have been in his 80s when I first met him. I had never heard of him until I worked at Cornelison. He was world famous. He had the most enormous pen nib collection from companies that had disappeared. They'd stopped making nibs 100 years ago, 50 years ago, beautiful steel and copper nibs. So there would be a constant stream of international visitors, in particular the Japanese, who seemed to have an obsession with pen nibs, especially antique pen nibs. And he was a great old guy. He was one of the founding members of the British Communist Party, which, much to his wife's chagrin, she did tell me, meant that she could never go to America with him because he was, of course, a communist.
Who sold pen nibs?
Absolutely. He was a dreadful threat to the United States. Yeah.
So you came to Australia in the late 80s, and what was your first port of call when you arrived here?
I had to get to Australia the cheapest way possible, and I was at this point stuck in Bangkok in Thailand. I'd been travelling through India and Nepal, cashing all of my return airfares, and take local buses all the way down to Singapore, where I get a cheap flight, the cheapest flight possible, Singapore to Darwin.
Right, so you land in Darwin.
Darwin.
What was your first encounter with Aboriginal cave art?
I was very lucky. I bumped into some people I'd met actually overseas, and they had just landed in Darwin at the same time. They just hired a car, and we went to Kakadu. So we went, and with one of the days we were there, we went with a ranger to see the cave paintings, wall paintings in Kakadu, which was a revelation for me because I'd really had no experience of this type of art at all.
Yeah, art with painted with ochre and with charcoal.
Yeah. I mean, what's extraordinary about the Australian Aboriginal culture, of course, is that it's actually a living culture. It's 50,000 plus years old and living continuously through that. Whereas we often look to, say, Europe or even North America and see also cave and wall paintings there, but they're sort of atrophied in the sense that they are historically, there was a cutoff point of that civilization. But all of them were linked by the use of certain types of colours because they were the most obviously available to them. Yellow ochres, red ochres, yellow ochres that could be burnt to make red ochres, black charcoals and white chalks.
One of the things that constantly astonishes me about reaction to Aboriginal painting or cave art is how strong it is in people outside of Australia.
For me, I think for the Europeans, I can't speak for other cultures, but certainly for myself, I think it is that realization that this is an unbroken thread that goes back to a point way beyond. You know, in Britain, we always celebrate things like Stonehenge. And Stonehenge is how many thousands of years old? And when we look at some of the artistic monuments, if you like, from Australian Aboriginal culture, they're twice as old, three times as old. And to realize that, as I said, that it's unbroken, that it's a fluid all the way through, flow all the way through from some point 50,000 years ago all the way to the present.
So without any money at all, you decided to hitchhike your way from Townsville down to Melbourne.
Yeah, that can't be hard, right?
That can't be hard in a country like Australia. How close is it? It's like going from Bristol to Bath,
exactly.
Isn't it? That's right.
It's actually
more like going from London to Moscow, isn't it, really, pretty much?
Well, so, you know, ignorance is a fantastic thing, isn't it? Naivety.
You never would have done it otherwise.
Yeah, I'd known what was involved, I don't think I ever would have done it. Basically, I ended up in Townsville, got dropped off on the highway. And I thought, okay, well, I mean, I've done it in Europe, I've done it in England, this can't be, how hard can it be? Certainly not really aware of the scale of the country, and started hitching. And now I look back and I cannot believe what happened. But within 20 minutes of me starting to hitch, a truck pulls up and the passenger door's flung open. The truckie, Alan, shouts down, where are you going? I say, Melbourne. He said, hop on in. And he was driving to Albury.
Non-stop?
Well, with Alan at that time, non-stop. With the amount of pills he was taking, yes, absolutely non-stop. Now, we would be doing runs on the way down from Townsville. We would be picking up bricks and then dropping them off and then picking up fruit and veg and then dropping them off and making our way down. It took about 5-6 days to make our way down. Within about 4 hours... sitting in the cab with Alan, and he was a Victorian guy, and he normally did his runs around northern Victoria, southern New South Wales. He was, in a sense, a fish completely out of water up this far. And what I realized after about 4 hours was that Alan had very limited reading capacity, and when driving in his own local area, not an issue, right? You know your streets, you know your roads, you know the sort of the landmarks. And he was in a little bit of difficulty, and there's that kind of Aussie male pride. And in this case, I realized what was going on. And without saying anything and without me actually bringing to his attention that I knew that he couldn't read the road signs, the direction signs, I would sort of be able to hint to him that this was the road we should be taking and da-da-da and da-da-da. And it went on like that, basically, for 4, 5, 6 days.
You can go through some pretty hairy areas down there, can't you, David? Did you ever feel unsafe at any stage hitchhiking?
Well, so the thing is, of course, if I'd stuck with Alan the whole way, we probably would have been completely safe. It just the problem was that, unfortunately, he was working to some quite tight deadlines, and he'd been, I have to say, using a fair amount of popping a fair few pills. And eventually, of course, he needed a sleep, and so he pulled over to a servo, and I was desperate to get down to Melbourne, where I knew some people. And so I said to Alan, I'm going to have to leave you. And he said, mate, you really shouldn't do it. But I said, I really have to go. So again, I get onto the highway, I start hitching. And instead, of course, getting the one hitch all the way down to Melbourne, it is a series of, you know, 20 kilometres, 100 kilometres if you're lucky. And that took me a few years later when the arrest came up to realize that I was hitchhiking through the Belanglo Forest at exactly the same time that Malat was picking up his overseas travelers. And it was weird because when there was the transcript there, the British hitchhiker Paul Onions, and he talked about how he got into Malat's car and he was highly aware of his surroundings and always had his hand very close to the door lever to get out. Again, I had my street smarts about me. I had the same feeling constantly. You tried to suss out someone really, really quickly. I was very lucky. Most of the people I hitched with were very nice people. It was just a very laborious way of getting down from the north of Australia down to Melbourne.
So once you arrived in Melbourne without much money, how did you then sort of embark on this idea that you might want to become a master paint maker?
Well, when I got down here, yeah, you're right, I didn't have any money. The girl I'd actually come down to see didn't want me staying there, and so she threw the Saturday morning age at me, open at the jobs vacant.
Old Aussie hospitality.
Very
once again, Dave. Hey, there you go. There's the Saturday age, right.
There was an advertisement in there for a job at an art shop. I phoned on the Monday, had the interview on the Tuesday, I was working on the Thursday. I was able to start making money straight away. What had happened was, the whole year that I was working on a working tourist visa, the whole thing, I was sort of soaking up as much of my environment in regards to what the Australian materials market was about, paints and drawing equipment, etc., and also getting to know a lot of the local artists. And it was then that I realised that there really, to my mind, wasn't an Australian-made paint to the quality that I would be passionate about that I had seen back in Europe. And I started to formulate an idea that I would do the same thing. I would actually set up in Australia. One of the great things about Australia at that time and still to this moment is it is a land of opportunity. I could never have set up my own company back in England. It would have cost me too much. So I'm here for a year. My visa runs out. I have to go back to England. I get my job back at Cornelison's, and like a giant sponge, I take as much information. And I'm fairly open with the owners of the business to explain what I'm going to do. And after about a year and a half extra, I take a one-way ticket and emigrate to Australia. So I land, and I set the company up on £1,000. That's what I had.
How do you typically get to work then? How do you build up a colour in an oil paint?
I'm a big believer in colours being as pure as possible. So what I prefer to do would be to make a paint that only uses one pigment. So the pigment, of course, is the colouring matter. If you imagine, it's really incredibly tiny grains of colour. And the pigment is bound, glued together with a binder. And for an oil paint, that's generally linseed oil. If I can keep the paint as simple as possible, I can get the largest amount of the pigment, the colorant matter, into the paint, which for the artist means they get the biggest amount of color and the best performance back out of it at the other end. There's a lot of incredibly close similarities to cooking. I mean, for a start, virtually all the machinery we use, and you've already mentioned about our triple roll mill, the granite rollers, it was used for cocoa processing. We mix now in 60-litre Hobart mixers, basically the dope, the mixers you see in a bakery for mixing flour and water, etc., and yeast together. And we will take our oil, our linseed oil, we put a what we call a stabilizer, which just helps the paint from falling apart, from separating in long-term storage. What a lot of artists don't realize is that the paint tube that they have just bought from the art shop was probably made 3 to 7 years ago. It's rested, it's then stored, it then just sits in the warehouse for a period of time before it gets sold, it then goes to a distributor, the distributor then holds onto it, goes to a retailer, the retailer holds onto it, eventually the artist comes in and uses it. And by the same token, depending on how much paint an artist is using, you yourself could have that paint in your studio for years. I've got tubes of paint that are 40 years old. What you hope for is that paint is as well made now as it was 40 years ago.
Synthetic colours. Mauve. Wasn't mauve the first synthetic colour?
Correct, absolutely. So William Perkins, by accident, creates the first synthetic colour. He was trying to create quinine as an anti-malarial drug, which obviously there was great demand for because of the British Raj. And by accident, he went off on a tangent, and his tenacity was to realize he'd made a mistake, but to continue through with the experiment to see what would happen. And he creates the first synthetic color, mauve. Society goes mad for mauvine. Of course, marketing in the 19th century was no different from now. They tried marketing it as Tyrian purple, you know, have the Roman experience connected to it. But very, very quickly, there was a discovery of all of these modern pigments from very simple coal tar dyes. In other words, these are from petroleum products.
And this is in the 19th century, isn't it?
This is in the mid-19th century.
And then do you then see the consequences of that in some of the great works of art produced from that period?
Oh, sure. I mean, in a good way and in a bad way. In the good way, it created the new super chromatically strong, in other words, very pure colours of what artists in particular from, say, the end of the First World War onwards would be using, things like the Hansa colours, aralides, and you can always tell a modern pigment by its tongue twister name. So it'd be aralides, diaralides, quinacridones, perylenes, diketo, pyrrolo, pyrroles. And so the chemistry of them is developed into their actual name rather than the poetry of Tyrian or flake white.
How did the invention of paint tubes change the nature of painting?
Enormously. I think that the two things for happened almost simultaneously. One of them, again, was modern chemistry with the invention of the cadmiums and the cobalts. And at virtually the same time, John Rand, an American artist, developed the collapsible lead tube. And suddenly artists were able to take their colours out into the field and paint without worrying about the colour in their what they'd been using before, which were pig's bladders, and they used to quite often and very inconveniently burst.
Right. On the train.
Imagine, yes, exactly. It's like a much worse experience of your pet biro leaking onto your white shirt. And suddenly it released artists out of the studio and went into the field. Without both the invention of the cadmiums and the cobalt, and more importantly with the collapsible tube, the Impressionism movement would never have occurred.
How do you make rose madder? Now, I was talking about that earlier. And what kind of a color is that? Is it a pinky color?
It's a beautiful, sweet, delicate pink, one of the very few pinks available and has ever been available. So there are lots of reds, but normally to make a pink, you have to add a white to it. Rose madder is, as it describes, it's a rose color, beautifully delicate. And it comes from the roots of the madder plant, a plant that has been used for dyeing for centuries all the way back. We know to the Indus Valley in the first 1,000 years prior to BC, to all the way through the Greeks and the Romans were using it, but being converted into a pigment didn't really happen until around about the 15th century. And the dye is drawn out of the root and is then converted into a pigment. But the root itself just looks like twigs. There's the very slightest pink tone to it, but you would never imagine that such exquisite colour could come out of a plant's roots.
And when do you source these exotic ingredients?
The great thing is that a lot of the histories have been reinvigorated because of old trades. The classic one being for us with the madder is that Iran, one of the great madder growing regions, and one of the reasons was because of the Persian rugs. And with the invention of the synthetic dyes in the late 19th century, virtually all rugs turned to using those, including Persian rugs. And they fell out of favor because they're garish and they don't fade well. All colors will fade. But synthetic colors fade in a very nasty way, and it's a very difficult thing to describe. But the color becomes brittle. Whereas natural dyes coming from natural sources, vegetable sources, they mellow as they fade. And so in the last 30 years, there's been an incredible reinvigoration of the use of natural dyes and, of course, then the actual growing of the plants to actually create those dyes.
Having gone to the trouble to set up a place that makes handmade paint, is there a market for that? I mean, do people want to buy that instead of buying paint at a much cheaper price?
You're right to say it's handmade, but to say that being handmade means it's going to be better is not necessarily true. I have always this constant internal battle when it comes to the idea of artisanal foods and artisanal beverages, artisanal jackets, I don't know, pick it. Everything's an artisanal thing now, right? The difference is that the quantities we're making are very much, much smaller. And more importantly, the reason why we're making it, we're not trying to make a mass-produced product. We're not trying to commodify and to homogenize our material. That would make it so much easier to make that way, and that's what the vast majority of manufacturers do. We make something that's very special, almost like a chef, I suppose, maybe a better way of describing it. And yes, there is a market. It's not the largest market. If I wanted to make money, I'd be making student paint. But I don't want to. I have no passion for that. I've only got one crack at this life, and I want to do something worth my while. And that's obviously the artist in me coming out.
Was it paint that brought you together with your wife?
It was. I was schlepping around the art shops. From the word go, I realized the power of marketing. And one of the big ones is that you always got to make yourself seem like you're bigger than you really are. I don't mean personally. I mean the business. And so I would always be using the royal we. But in fact, in the end, of course, I ended up doing everything, and including the repping. So I used to turn up at the art shops. Louise was working at an art shop. And I saw her, and I thought she was very cute, but I was also quite stupid and quite self-reliant. I'd spent so many years having come to Australia just living on my own, and I think really probably quite heavily focused that way. Louise would come out and ask me all these technical questions of things that I later found out she knew all of the answers anyway, and just kept asking me questions until eventually one of those days it ended up that it was closing time, and she took me out for a drink, and that was it. I was a goner.
This is how people flirt in an art shop.
That's right. Yes. Yes. It's quite geeky, isn't it, really?
It's been really great to speak with you, David, and lovely to talk to you about the history of colour and paint like this. It's been fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you for having me.
David Coles's exhibition is called Chromatopia. That's on in Melbourne at Tacit Contemporary Art. abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.